Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Alan Boulos. Dr. Boulos is the chair of the neurosurgery department at Albany Medical Center. He specializes in the surgical and endovascular management of cerebrovascular disorders of the brain. That's stroke, aneurysm, vessel stenosis, and AVM. He is also an expert in surgery for brain tumors. Dr. Boulos earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College, where he also completed his internship and residency. He also completed a fellowship in endovascular neurosurgery at Millard Fillmore Hospital in Buffalo. He's a member of the American College of Surgeons, the American Heart Association, the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, the Congress of Neurological Surgeons, and the Society of Neurointerventional Surgery. If you have a question for Dr. Boulos, and many people already are getting on the phone, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Boulos, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I know how busy you are, and I know how many people need to see you, but this is a great opportunity for all of us to ask you questions. So how do you know when you're having a stroke?
A stroke is a symptom that begins acutely. So it's the typical symptoms include loss of vision abruptly, either an eye or both eyes could be affected, or weakness in an arm or leg, or drooping of the face, numbness, difficulty with speech or understanding speech are the most common symptoms with stroke.
And when people have a stroke, what's their chance? What are their chances of getting better?
Well, many strokes do get better, but others can progress, and some will remain. So it's very important to get medical care as soon as the symptoms begin. Unlike heart attack, many strokes are painless. There's no pain associated with them. And so the wrong answer is to sleep it off, because a lot of those patients will unfortunately suffer irreversible harm.
Right.
And those symptoms will not get better.
And so you need to get we were talking a little bit before, you need to get to an expert place within 6 hours. Is that right?
That's right. So last year, there were 3 randomized trials published that all showed the advantage of a catheter-based procedure to improve the chances of somebody recovering from stroke. And what that means is we, much like they do for the heart, we go up through the blood vessels of the body and place a device, a stent retriever, into the clot inside the brain vessel, and then we pull the clot out.
Whoa. That's impressive.
It's a very exciting time, because prior to 2015, we did not have trial evidence to show how much benefit there was.
And how much is there, just to recap?
It's dramatic. Over 50% will be in good functional condition, compared to about 20 to 30% without the treatment. So it doubles your chances of being better off.
And so I asked you before, how does a guy like you, I mean, you're the top of the top, how do you learn to do these procedures? And the answer was?
Well, the catheter-based training takes 2 years of fellowship training, and it can be done after the residency training, either from neurosurgery. There are 3 neurosurgeons at Albany Medical Center that do it, and we rotate with a call schedule. Alternatively, you can come from neurology or from radiology, and learn those skills with a 2-year fellowship as well.
So neurologists are allowed to do this procedure because it's not considered exclusively surgeon's stuff.
Right. With the proper training, they can.
Right. Now, is this training you're talking about? You went to Buffalo, you took your family, you went for 2 years.
Correct.
Is it part of the new curriculum? In other words, if you're a resident now, will you learn this without having to go back to take the 2 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. 2 years is the training regimen. Many residents currently will incorporate some of that or all of that training within their residency. And if they can get the 2 years completed, then they may finish graduating with the experience. Now, to do that, neurosurgery residency is 7 years, so you can incorporate the 2 years in a 7-year program. But in neurology, it's a shorter residency, so they can't incorporate the full 2 years into it, or else they wouldn't get a chance to learn the other material.
Interesting, interesting. That's terrific. Let's go to Ann in Hudson. Ann, you're on.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. What you got?
Basically, 4 years ago, I had a stroke. I was 38, and it was a cerebellar stroke. So there was a clot in my left vertebral artery, and pica was affected. And after the 6 months of Coumadin, the clot went away, and I was left with a space in my vessel in pica that was, the vessel actually sealed over, is how it was explained to me. So there's a blockage there now. So I'm just wondering, or I wanted to ask the doctor, how the vessels are going to act now, how they're going to provide adequate blood flow, what they're doing, you know, now that there's that sealed over spot in my head in pica.
What's pica, doctor?
So pica is one of the branches that comes off the vertebral artery. We have four arteries that run through the neck going to the brain. The two carotid arteries that most people are familiar with in the front of the neck, they go on to form the main arteries of the brain called the middle and anterior cerebral arteries. And then in the back of the brain, there are two vertebral arteries that run through our spinal canal. They run through bone in the cervical vertebra. And they can often get injured because of our mobility at a young age. These vertebral arteries can get injured within the bony canals, and that may have been what happened in your case. And what happened?
It was actually determined that that wasn't the case.
Okay.
But go on. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, it can be variable. It could also be from thickened blood that could cause a clot in the vertebral artery. But in any event, the pica is one of the main arteries that goes to the cerebellum, and the cerebellum controls a lot of the activities that we don't think about. So we walk without consciously thinking about walking, and so the cerebellum controls those activities. Or when we speak, we don't really think about our tongue and lips moving. The cerebellum plays a role in those activities. And so when a stroke occurs in that region, it can affect any of those things. So you can develop a tremor, or you could develop a lack of coordination. Fortunately, a lot of symptoms do get better with time, but it certainly can leave residual symptoms. Potentially with swallowing is another one that can be affected with pica. In terms of what she should do now, the Coumadin is effective at reopening the vertebral artery, but often the small vessel within the brain, the pica, can stay occluded, and the damage occurs at the time of the occlusion. So there isn't ongoing damage because the vessel's occluded. It injured a certain part of the brain, but the rest of the brain has helped, the other vessels have helped that region, and so it's what we call a fixed stroke. So opening that vessel now is dangerous, and it won't necessarily make her any better neurologically.
And we got five people on the phone, but if you give us a real fast comeback, if you have one, go ahead.
Okay, so do I need any kind of MRI, like yearly or anything like this?
I think
to kind of check what the vessels are doing. In other words, I'm concerned about like an aneurysm effect. I mean, does the pressure in your system now hit that blockage and create kind of like a bulging or an aneurysm effect, or is that not possible?
It shouldn't. No, it shouldn't.
Okay.
Usually the occlusion occurs at the origin, and so there isn't when the aneurysms usually form at the branch point. I do think it'd be worthwhile, since your vertebral artery was affected, they could check on that with an MRA once every few years just to make sure that the vessel's still wide open and that it's healed properly. If it looks good, then I think it'd be okay not to continue to check it.
And an MRA as opposed to I is?
An MRA is using the same machine as an MRI, but it's very specifically looking at moving blood, and so it gives us a good picture of the blood vessels.
Great. Okay, and thank
you. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, we'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, go ahead.
How does Clostridium botulinum affect the nervous system?
This is not really my expertise, but botulinum toxin is used to paralyze reduce spasm in the muscles because it affects the neuromuscular junction so that the nerve can no longer control the muscle. So in patients who have spasm of the muscle causing pain or disfigurement, then the botulism toxin can be injected, causing the blockade between the nervous to muscular system, and that causes muscle relaxation and improves the pain condition.
Okay, Jim, it's a little off topic, so we're going to let you go. Thank you. We'll go to Ann in Beacon. Ann, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
About 3 months ago, my husband had what was classified as a small, deep stroke. more serious than a TIA, but definitely leaving his right side impaired. And he is on several new drugs, which he hadn't been on before for high blood pressure and cholesterol. But the question is, he was not able to have an MRI at the time because he has a pacemaker. So other tests revealed significant blockage, and all in the vertebral artery area. And we were told, don't even think about trying to do some intervention in that area. The question is this, is his continued weakness, I mean, he's a fit 75-year-old other than having have serious occlusion, apparently. Is this fatigue and occasional smirking, is one of the, I'm thinking of Ann and Hudson, smirking, long-term effect of, you know, what are the long-term effects of stroke? What, where can we expect to see improvement in his strength? And, or might these be symptoms of continued small strokes or TIAs?
Okay, and we're up against a break here. So, Doc, if you could give us a fastie and a very long question. Thank you.
Well, so with stroke, there are permanent symptoms. What's important to look at is the fluctuating course of the symptoms. So if the symptoms worsen and get better and worsen and get better, or if they're progressively getting worse, then that's a patient that should be reevaluated because there may be a way to improve that situation by opening a blood vessel and improve the perfusion. The fact that there are some persistent symptoms, though, that's not surprising. A lot of times patients get better over the ensuing 2 years after a stroke. But if they do fluctuate, if they get worse, then that's more typical of brain that is having further injuries, and maybe there's a procedure that could be done to help that situation. Does that make sense?
Sure. Okay.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. There's lots of free phones right now, four of them, as a matter of fact, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for information. Ichiban, Japanese and Chinese restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And from HPA LiveWell, Albany, New York, providing intensive outpatient psychological services for treatment of eating disorders in and around the Capital Region, albanyhpa.com. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Fulton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988, lglc.org. And from Kent Hicks Construction, specializing in deep energy retrofits, passive house, zero energy homes, and historic restorations, serving Western Massachusetts for over 25 years. KentHicksConstruction.com.
And we are back with Dr. Alan Boulos. Thank you, everybody, for calling. We have four free phones right now. That's a lot. It took about 3 seconds to get five going before. I just want you to know that if you want to get in, this is the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Diane. Okay, Diane, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Doctor. This morning I had a sudden onset of lightheadedness, and it was followed approximately 5 or 6 seconds later by double vision, which lasted for 3 or 4 minutes. Could this possibly be an ophthalmic migraine?
It can be. Usually ophthalmic migraines also involve vision loss or floaters. Double vision is more concerning because it means the two eyes are not looking at the same object identically.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are nerves that could be affected by that. And the brainstem, where also it controls the centers for balance that can cause the vertigo as well. So it's a fairly common set of symptoms to have vertigo with associated double vision. What should be important is to check your blood pressure. Sometimes if the blood pressure is low, it can bring those symptoms on. Sometimes if it's very high, it can also cause some symptoms like that. And then also, I would consider if it's repeatedly happening that you should get seen by a doctor regarding the possibility of the vertebral arteries.
It occurred about 6 or 7 years ago, and I did have brain imaging at that time, and it was negative.
And you continue to have these symptoms regularly?
This is the second time in the last 6 or 7 years.
Oh.
Second episode.
Both are at the time when you wake up early in the morning?
Yeah, it was this morning, but I had been up for a while.
Okay. Something to watch out for, sometimes the blood pressure. That's
okay.
The most common cause for this. If that's not the case.
Low or high.
If that's not the case, then it might be worth getting the brain checked again.
Okay.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. David in New Paltz. David.
Yes. Hello. I have a question. I had neuropathy develop 2 years ago after a hematoma. Excess blood had developed in my thigh, and according to the neurologist, it completely crushed my nerve that goes down into my leg, my right leg. And since that time, I've had no feeling for part of the leg and part of the foot, and also no motor function in my foot. And I'm wondering if the doctor has any sense of any way that my leg nerve can be assessed to get a sense of whether it's really growing back or how long it might take, and also if there are any new kinds of treatments that have been developed over the last couple years. I've had several neurologists tell me there's nothing to be done, just have to see if it comes back or not.
Okay, Doc, so let's start with the definition of what a neuropathy is.
A neuropathy is pathology affecting the nervous system. In his case, the peripheral nervous system we're talking about. And so it sounds like this happened as a result of a blood clot formation causing compression on the nerve. Normally,
actually, it was excess blood because of bad advice about blood thinner proof for some other thing going on.
So you were on a blood thinner, and then there was some leaking of the blood vessels?
Yeah.
And that formed a blood clot.
Caused a huge swelling and pain in my thigh, and then that apparently ended up, once I was in the hospital, ended up crushing the nerve.
Yeah. So typically when the hematoma absorbs and the pressure is relieved on the nerve can heal again, but it can take a long, long time because it really has to grow all the way from where those neurons are located in the spinal cord all the way back down the leg again. So it can take months to years for that to happen. If it doesn't happen, if it persists, then you can look at studies like nerve conduction tests and EMGs, which I'm sure you've had done, to see if there's been improvement. In other words, if we can see that the earliest branch points of that nerve are starting to come back, then that gives you hope that the rest will come back with more time. If it's not coming back at all, the alternatives are fairly involved. You could have surgery done where they expose where the nerve is. They have to expose above where the blood clot formed and beyond where the blood clot formed, and then check the conduction across the nerve in the open field. And if there is conduction, then that's the entire procedure with the hope that it will heal on its own. If there is no conduction and it's been a long time since the injury, then you could take a graft. You take a nerve somewhere else in your leg, harvest it, and graft it. With the hope that that will heal. But that will take years because it has to grow again from the spinal cord all the way down to the foot.
What if you just leave it alone?
That's what he's been doing.
Right.
And that may be the best choice, as I mentioned. If you check, though, electrically and you see improvements, then that would suggest it's going to continue to get better.
David, I'm sorry to let you go, but there are a lot of people on the line. Thank you. Let's go to Robert in Niskayuna. Robert, you're on.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to mention that I'm an emergency medicine colleague of Dr. Burroughs and that I've had nothing but positive experience with him. He's a superb and caring physician. What I want to mention, ask about is, could Dr. Burroughs speak briefly about the evaluation by sports professionals such as coaches as well as medical professionals like myself who might be on the field of evaluating a head injury such as in football in the other than obvious circumstance where there's been a major loss of consciousness, etc., but in the more subtle circumstance as to what youngsters should be immediately transferred for evaluation, etc.?
That's a great question. It's a tough issue, obviously very controversial, but I can say that as we continue to learn, we are getting more experience on repeated head injuries being a very very important possible cause for later on cognitive decline. And so it's a little biased for me because I'm a neurosurgeon, so I tend to want to restrict people's activities as much as possible. And it's easy for me to say and hard for kids to do. But I think certainly if someone has double vision, any transient confusion, disorientation, even if brief, those really symbolize that the brain has been shooken badly enough to stop working properly, and that carries that's a brain injury of sorts. And it, certainly going back on the field in that scenario, I think carries that risk of what we call the double hit injury, and the second concussion or the second brain injury is usually more significant and has a longer lasting impact on the patient.
So should we outlaw? Should we outlaw, football?
I don't know about outlawing football. It's a sport everyone agrees to play. Nobody's being forced to play it, but it does carry significant risk.
Yeah, I'd outlaw it. But anyway, what do I care? Let's go to Timothy in Scotia, 1-800-348-2551. Timothy, you're on.
Good afternoon, Alan.
Hey.
I have a Parkinson's patient, 64 years old. Was quite a fair amount of vertigo at times, and that's the major, and nausea. But to get to the point, the neurosurgeon you have, Dr.
Ulos.
Ulos. My father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather all died from cerebral hemorrhages. Is there a multiplier effect, either from Parkinson's on cerebral or cerebral on Parkinson's? I also have a meningioma on the upper right frontal lobe.
The family.
Does this increase my chances of having a stroke?
Parkinson's disease doesn't increase the chances of cerebral hemorrhages, to my knowledge, significantly. But certainly the family history is concerning. A common link, though, could be hypertension. So hypertension carries a fairly significant, high blood pressure carries a significant risk to bleeding over the long term. And so it can run in families, that condition, and our ability to treat it certainly has gotten much better in the current age than it was 40 or 50 years ago. So I think it is important that family history is very relevant. I'm not sure the Parkinson's plays a big role in that risk, though.
Is it meningioma?
The meningioma is a benign brain tumor that occurs on the outside of the brain. With time, it can grow and exert pressure on the brain and sometimes require surgery. But in and of itself, that could be watched safely in most cases if it's small and not causing symptoms.
Okay.
Thank you, Timothy. I want to get to everybody else.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yep, bye. Let's go to Mary in Woodstock. Mary, go. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Hi, Doctor. My grandson has sickle cell disease, and he was on transfusion therapy until he was about 20, and now he's been on hydroxyurea for about 2 years. And I just wondered if the risk for a stroke decreases with age, and if the hydroxyurea is beneficial in decreasing that risk.
Doctor, what is hydroxyurea?
Hydroxyurea is it's a kind of medication used to lyse the platelets, which allows for the blood to be thinned a little bit,
okay,
and then allows for better flow. I think it's a sickle cell trait or disease does carry increased risk of stroke. I'm not sure it gets worse as age goes on. I think the risk exists. The capillaries and the smaller vessels are the more typical cause for the stroke in those patients because the flow is abnormal.
And what is sickle cell again?
Sickle cell is a disease where the red blood cells are affected so that they behave abnormally.
Okay.
They don't flow appropriately, and they can cause occlusions in small vessels, causing strokes at a young age.
Okay.
I mean, that's been brought up a couple of times. Stroke is often thought of as a disease of the elderly, but clearly it's not. As you've heard from these callers, we see it in the whole spectrum from pediatrics throughout adulthood.
Wow. Yeah. Mary, anything else on that?
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. Okay, Veronica in Kingston, 1-800-348-2551. Veronica, go.
Yes, hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can barely hear you, so keep your mouth close to the microphone.
Okay. It's an embarrassing question, but upon the orgasm, it gets a very extreme headache at the top of the head, like an explosion in the top of the head. It lasts, maybe 45 seconds or so.
This is not the first time we've had this particular question.
It's a fairly common finding.
Yeah.
I don't know that I know the answer to what is causing it. It most likely has to do with the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Some people implicate migraines in the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, so it's certainly possible that you can have pretty severe headaches in and around the time of orgasm, and it's definitely been... I don't have much in the way of therapy for it, unfortunately, but it is a fairly common finding.
I've heard this from both men and women, which is
interesting.
Yeah. Veronica, any comeback?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay. Well, Veronica, thank you for calling. We wish we could do more.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Chris in Schenectady. Chris in Schenectady, you're on. Go.
Hi. I would like to know, as a kid, I got in an automobile accident, and I was diagnosed with a sciatica. I don't have any pain, at least where that's concerned, but I was wondering, and later on in life, does it come back to where I have to be on medication?
You don't have pain now?
No pain.
No, it doesn't necessarily come back. No, that's good. If you're relieved of the pain, then it may not come back. Is that the question?
Well, as a fellow sciatica sufferer, I can tell you, be happy when it's gone.
And it depends on the cause, and the motor vehicle accident is a kind of extreme mechanism to cause the pain. So most likely, fortunately for you, you've recovered, the nerve has recovered, and hopefully the situation won't re-arise.
Chris, did you have surgery?
I didn't have surgery. I broke the left femur, so as I had a steel rod in there as well for 10 years. So once that was removed, a lot of my pain went away.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Thank you, Chris.
The nerve runs by there, so that was irritating.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, we'll go to Michael in Long Lake. Okay, Michael, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Michael, you're on.
Thank you very much. I have a question for the doctor. Following rotator cuff surgery on my left arm, I had and still occasionally have hyperalgesia where I could not stand. I couldn't stand my T-shirt on, the sheet on. I'm wondering if that's a common side effect, and I'm hoping that I continue to recover from it as it has diminished.
Doctor, what is it?
Hyperalgesia is where the skin is so sensitive that you get sharp shooting pains with any touch of that skin area.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And presumably this was like along your deltoid?
Yeah, actually it was on the inside of my arm. I had a detached bicep tendon that also got repaired.
So with any surgery, there's any chance of injuring the nerves in and around the region. Sounds like this was, as it relates to a nerve injury at the time of surgery, and the nerve is healing with time, so that's the good news, and it does usually get better.
Yeah, that's
but right. It's a fairly uncommon effect of that surgery, I think, but maybe that second point that he was making about the biceps, maybe it would be more common in that scenario versus
it often starts inside the arm and then spreads out, but as I said, I am happy that it is diminishing.
Okay. Hey, Michael, let you go. Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Nathan Litauer Hospital, proudly introducing the gastroenterology specialist of Litauer with Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Ramani, and Dr. Ramon, NLH.org. Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, custom-designed panelized house kits featuring eco-friendly passive and solar design elements, noble-home.net. And from Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses including Bevel, Lafont, and Pro Design, progressive lenses from Verilux and Nikon, and Maui Jim, Costa, and Ray-Ban sunglasses, SHEEHYOpticians.com. And from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting the Capital Region's National Natural Landmark with an interactive visitor center, guided programs, and 20 miles of trails, albanypinebush.org.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. Doc, we got an email. Hello. A good client of mine, Dr. Pat Lydon of Los Angeles, California, has been working on research using hypothermic-induced coma to reduce damage in severe stroke cases. Have you heard of this? And do you have any knowledge of using this for treatment?
Yeah, so hypothermia, reducing the body temperature in the setting of acute stroke, has been shown to work in a lot of research and preclinical testing in animal research. It's also clearly effective in cardiac arrest patients who suffer cognitive decline because the heart has stopped working, the brain is not getting blood flow, and so hypothermia for that patient is a standard of care in many places.
Wow.
We continue to struggle in proving that it works in the clinical situation of stroke. Dr. Lydon is studying it, and there have been some trials looking at it. So far, we haven't proven its effectiveness, but as I mentioned earlier, last year we, for the first time, showed effectiveness with these catheter-based procedures,
sure.
And it could be just we got to get the right degree of hypothermia, and we got to work on getting the right timing, the earlier the better, and the right window. Is it 24 hours, 48 hours? So there's a lot of variables. My suspicion is if we can get all of that in the right scenario, then we would help patients because there's so much evidence that dropping the temperature does help preserve brain function in the setting of a stroke.
That's great. Okay, well, thank you for that. Let's go to Sue in Ballston Lake, but not before I say 1-800-348-2551. Go, Sue.
Hi, good afternoon. Timely program for me personally. My husband, Dr., had a stroke a month ago, and the area of the stroke was in the hippocampus, which he was at Albany Med, admitted he had wonderful care. My question is, his onset was very sudden. He had what they call global amnesia for 24 hours, and he's regained most of his cognitive function except for his personality, which has dramatically changed. And I don't know, I'm just wondering if you could give me some feedback as maybe what could have caused it. We don't know what caused it. It looks like there was a narrowing of the arteries, but again, there was no clot. It was very deep in the brain. And is this rare? And just some basic information that would help me as his wife, a nurse, who kind of like was really taken back because I've never seen this kind of a symptom where he just didn't know at all where he was. He became very confused. So thank you. I'll wait for your response.
Oh, thank you. It is an unusual situation. The hippocampus is one of the, there's a hippocampus on either side, and together they're both critical for making new memories. And so it doesn't surprise me that if one was affected, that it might have caused the amnesia and potentially could affect his ability to acquire new memories. If he's right-handed, then the left hippocampus tends to be dominant, and that's the one that's most used for memory processing. The personality changes isn't classically described by the hippocampus as being a source, but there are other structures around the hippocampus in the limbic system, and that is called the deep brain system, and it certainly can affect emotions and personality. And so I guess thinking about it, it does make sense that it would affect personality. but probably the surrounding structures are more implicated in that. In terms of what to do, stroke does patients do recover from stroke, and it takes time, sometimes up to 2 years. So I think that there's a good chance that he's going to make progress and improve. I don't know what the window will be in terms of how quickly the recovery will be. In terms of the last question about the cause, as you mentioned, you kind of go through a pretty exhaustive testing to figure out what the cause is. It's an unusual stroke pattern because it must be one of the smaller vessels going to that area of the brain that had the stroke. That could be from high blood pressure. That could be from what we call hypercoagulable state, so thickened blood. Or it could be from something like vasospasm related to medications or something like that where the arteries are constricted.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Sue.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay. Can somebody just have a personality, what appears a personality change from being scared to death by getting a stroke?
Yeah, that's a great point, too. It could be anxiety related to the event or sure. to the disability.
Right. Let's go to Catherine. Okay, in Saratoga Springs. Okay, Catherine, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. I have two younger brothers. Both have had strokes. And one of them has passed away. And, I'm wondering, when I discussed it with my doctor, I've had what I think it were TMIs a couple of times.
TIA.
Where I have double vision, lose my balance, that kind of thing. But it passes, so I never did anything about it. And so I asked her about taking an aspirin, 81 milligrams. And she said that won't do any good. I have to take a whole aspirin every day to prevent a stroke. So I guess I got two questions there. You know, what's my chances of, or what's my risk of having a stroke based on my siblings? And should I be taking a whole aspirin every day?
So the aspirin dose is controversial. A baby aspirin does work for most people, but basically we all have a certain amount of enzyme that can metabolize the aspirin. And for some of us, we metabolize it so well that it becomes ineffective. And so an adult dose aspirin increases your chances that you're going to be treated appropriately. And so that's why it was recommended. You can even take two full dose aspirins, and that would increase your chances even more that you would not resist the aspirin. And so you can get the effect from a baby aspirin all the way to two or three adult dose aspirins. But obviously, as you go with the higher doses, there's more irritability to the stomach, more risk for GI upset or possibly even GI bleeding. In terms mm-hmm. of the other question about your brothers having a stroke, certainly the genetics and the familial factor is there. There can be other factors. Smoking is the biggest modifiable risk factor for stroke. So if somebody's smoking, that increases the risk of stroke.
And we know that for sure.
Yeah, there's a definite relationship between smoking and increased risk for stroke.
Okay, I am an ex-smoker. My one of my brothers never smoked, although he grew up in a smoky household because both my parents smoked. And I'm an ex-smoker, and my other brother smoked right till the end. So, I quit like 19 years ago. I am 68 years old.
Well, that's great. I mean, those benefits are there at that point. You're in the non-smoking kind of category at this point. The answer to the question is, again, make sure you keep your blood pressure well controlled. Stopping your smoking is great, and aspirin is also good. Doing more than that probably would create more harm than good, so I think that's a good balance.
Catherine, we're going to let you go. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Jay Annie in Albany. Okay, Annie, you're on.
Hi. So I am a longtime sufferer of chronic migraines, and I know that with certain medications and like lifestyle choices, the risk of stroke is higher when you are a female with migraines. So I'm wondering what the difference is. I know the symptoms are fairly similar, but how to tell the difference between a stroke and a migraine and when to get medical attention?
That's a good question. So the word stroke can be a little confusing because there are two different kinds of stroke. There's an ischemic stroke, which is 80% of the strokes that are described are ischemic strokes. And those are actually painless. You develop the neurologic symptoms, either facial weakness, arm weakness, difficulty with speech, vision loss. So those are symptoms that come on without any associated pain. And that's the kind that we talked about earlier about getting to the hospital as quick as possible, because if there's a vessel that's occluded, we can reopen it either with the intravenous clot busting drug, or if it's a larger vessel, you might need the catheter-based procedure. In terms of headaches, that's not typical for an ischemic stroke, but it can be a scenario of a hemorrhagic stroke. So if there's bleeding around the brain from an aneurysm rupture, it's still called a stroke, but that's going to cause a lot of irritation to the covering of the brain, which then causes severe headaches. That headache usually is associated with abrupt onset, with nausea and vomiting, and it's pretty much out of proportion to anything anyone's experienced before. Invariably, those patients, even if they're migraineurs, will come saying this headache was way beyond anything they had experienced before. And it's important to get, again, medical attention as soon as possible. So I hope that answers the question.
Annie, thank you. Okay, Doc, before I let you go, and we have a few more minutes here, but I wanted to know, because all of us are always worried about this silent killer, this aneurysm business. Is there any way we can sort of diagnose whether or not we're potentially bombs getting ready for an aneurysm?
Well, brain aneurysms occur probably in 2 to 3% of the population at large.
That's a lot.
That's a fair bit, yes. We don't screen routinely for it. Certainly, if you have a family risk factor, a primary relative that's had an aneurysm diagnosis or rupture, then you might get an MRA of the brain to look for an aneurysm. Basically, as the if you are diagnosed with an aneurysm, if it's very small, it may be observed because the risk of bleeding is low. But as the aneurysm is diagnosed at a larger size, then the risk of rupture becomes higher, and treatment ahead of the rupture can be very helpful.
And you do that how? Do you go in there?
Yeah, there are two approaches. There's a catheter-based approach that we mentioned in terms of the stroke that we talked about before. In these cases, we have other alternatives. We can place coils in the aneurysm and occlude the aneurysm from within. We can also place stents in the artery and redirect the flow from the aneurysm into the artery, and that can allow the aneurysm to heal. And then there's surgery, microsurgery, where we have to open the skull and use the microscope to place a clip or clamp on the aneurysm itself.
Whoa. Okay, thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Joseph in Woodstock. Joseph.
Hi.
Yo, Joseph, go.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, very much.
So I wonder if the doctor would be kind enough to comment on the neurological vulnerabilities of the elderly subjected to general anesthesia, because I think that it's a topic that's not really discussed very much, and people are often blindsided by the effects of general anesthesia. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not an authority on this subject, but I will admit readily that I think that you're right, that the effects of anesthesia on the elderly is probably not well understood and does have an impact. And what that means is when you put someone to sleep, the blood pressure can fluctuate, it can drop or go up, and controlling the, at least I guess this is a neurosurgeon talking, so I think the blood flow to the brain can be affected in that scenario in a patient who's more sensitive to it. And so certainly people after those kinds of procedures, even if they had surgery on their leg or on their back, can wake up confused with worsening memory problems. A lot of times it does get better with time, but there are patients probably who don't fully recover from that. So I do think general anesthesia can impact the cognition of patients, and particularly gets worse as we get older.
So the relationship of the neurosurgeon with the anesthesiologist has to be crucial, doesn't it?
It is. It's a very important relationship to discuss. Every case we discuss, the blood pressure management, what we're going to do, and what the plan for the procedure is.
Good question, Joseph. Thank you. Let's go to Lauren in Troy. Okay, Lauren, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I just had a question for the doctor about Parkinson's after DBS. Probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years after the DBS. And my friend has been falling quite a bit and says that when he's walking, he gets gray and feels faint and, then goes down. And I'm wondering, is this something we're going to expect more of? He's deciding on, situation right now. Is that a typical Parkinson's progress, or something might be suggested for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure I have complete ability to answer it, but DBS is deep brain stimulation. In patients with Parkinson's disease, they can place an electrode into the brain substance itself, and then they turn it on, and it becomes kind of a pacemaker of the brain, if you will, to control the tremor and to improve the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. It doesn't,
yes,
though.
He had quite a bit of improvement.
Yeah, it doesn't reverse the Parkinson's disease. It helps with the symptoms. And so mm-hmm. I think you're right that the Parkinson's disease can progress, and this may represent that progression several years later after the DBS was put in. The other possibility, though, with the way you described it, is again, it may be a cardiac cause or hypotension. When you said he feels faint and graying, and then he falls, it could be an unrelated problem. Though Parkinson's disease does affect the nervous system, even the nervous system of the heart, so they may still be related. But there might be some strategies, though, to prevent those episodes as it relates to his heart.
So to bring that up at his next visit, something, I know he's followed regularly. I just wondered if there might be just, you know, something more to look into. So thank you very much for that.
Sure.
Okay, we could have taken one more, but I think people begin to get the idea that by the end of the show, they don't get in. But in this case, they outfox themselves. They would have. There were five phones going for most of this hour. So neurosurgery and neurology used to be very separate. But now, in your description of the way things are going, procedures are available to neurologists that never were before. And so there is a sort of coming together, yes or no, on these issues.
In many of these conditions, the disciplines have to work very closely. The discussion about the deep brain stimulation, that's a movement disorders neurology program that the neurosurgeon interacts with. Who's the best patients to have the DBS inserted? What settings do you use? You go back and forth discussing it. So in epilepsy, we have surgery for epilepsy now. And so the epileptologists, the neurologists, work with the neurosurgeon on deciding the best patients for surgery. And then, as you saw with stroke, we work closely with our neurologists who specialize in stroke. So the two fields are very closely related. As medicine continues to grow in our knowledge base, we all can't do everything, so we have to work together more and more.
Well, that's great. Is it, doctor, is there a sense that the medicines are becoming better?
Absolutely. Stroke was the third leading cause for mortality in the population. It's now fifth, and I think that's largely because of the benefits of the statins and other medical therapies that we've instituted for cardiac disease. We're seeing a reduction in stroke incidence. It's not a huge reduction. It's still a big cause for disability, but it's an improvement. And so I think medications continue to make a difference.
So we're looking at different medications. It's interesting because I've been following these studies, and the statins don't always do all that well, but others like Zetia, which is a different class of drug, do better. Do we know why this is happening?
I mean, I think Zetia affects the cholesterol absorption pathway, and so it reduces your cholesterol. But the statins still, I think, have a pretty profound effect, not just on cholesterol numbers, but on stabilization of the plaque.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it. Yeah. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. And it's been a terrific program. Dr. Boulos, I want to thank you for doing all that you have done for all of us. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Vassa Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee resurfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. Thanks for joining us today on the Vox Pop, everyone. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.